This is VPR Presents. I'm Liam Connors. John Hockenberry is the host of WNYC and Public Radio International's The Takeaway, and he spoke at St. Michael's College on November 4th. His lecture, Climate of Doubt, focused on the way the discussion on climate change has shifted since 2008.
What a great turnout. Thanks so much for coming out on these beautiful fall days here in Vermont, which are only a sign of exactly what we're here to talk about, I guess, which is global warming. Falls in Vermont haven't always been this pleasant, or at least this temperate. Certainly the colors are as spectacular as ever. Signs of climate change are everywhere. It's great to be here. It's great to be in Vermont in a nuclear-free zone. I always feel safer when I'm up here in Vermont. And I have a very interesting experience of having visited here as a journalist, and I'll talk about that briefly, even though our main focus tonight is environmental policy and some of the work that I've done as an environmental reporter. Although I will say right at the outset, I'm not an environmental expert or a beat reporter that typically does work on the environment. I've interviewed James Hansen, who was the scientist who really blew the whistle on climate change for the U.S. government and was punished for it, and shows up in Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, which I suspect many of you saw, right? Yep. And I certainly do know enough about science and planetary science to understand what the IPCC's report is all about and what will be the issue and issues that will be discussed in Paris later this year as the world leaders gather to try to execute a real plan to, if not arrest global warming, to provide what I think is a template for adaptation, because that's, I think, where we're at. We're no longer thinking in terms of stopping global warming or somehow pretending as though 10 billion people can live on the planet in an industrialized sort of position and not produce significant effects on the environment. So there will be adaptations. Some of those adaptations will be draconian. Some of those adaptations will be catastrophic in the case of, you know, the Marshall Islands, for instance, that won't be here by the end of this century. And almost every prediction suggests that that's the case. But I think one of the things that's important to remember about climate change now is that it's transitioned from a science story to a political story. And I don't mean political story in the more trivial sense. And I say trivial sense in that the frontline piece that I did that I won't play again because I think it's, you know, we've really moved on, but I will tell you a lot of stories about the reporting of that story. Climate of Doubt is what it was about, and it's very much about how the political discourse in America, the way the media operates, and the extent to which very well-motivated and highly financed individuals can have a huge influence in debates where a scientific expertise is really important to evaluate what is actually going on. And in the absence of that expertise, people are prone to being manipulated. And as we know in America, we are a nation that is in love with its own creation myths. I mean, we are the greatest country on earth. We are dedicated to freedom and the fact that we also live upon the lands of a series of ethnic races and tribes that were nearly exterminated, and our industrial economy was built on the slavery of Africans who have become African Americans, is a minor detail in the mythology of American life. Something that we are discovering is a peril for our political system going forward. We trade in myths in the political system, and so it's very, very easy to create a myth about climate change when you're already dealing with a lot of pre-existing myths about American politics. And so we'll talk about that a little bit. But it's interesting that we gather today because I interviewed Al Gore today, who's I just actually drove up from Boston after interviewing Gore for the program, The Takeaway. We may have a couple of clips from that interview on the program tomorrow, but mostly we are saving that interview for the day after Thanksgiving when we're doing a whole hour on climate change on my radio program and taking a look at the issues in Paris and some of the questions of pragmatic changes that have taken place in the world politically to really reduce energy consumption, to give people an awareness about their imprint, their carbon imprint, their energy imprint, their consumption imprint, and everything from the excessive waste in the food chain. And when I mean the food chain, I mean the agricultural food chain, how much food we waste, and the environmental consequences of all that organic material ending up in landfills, which produces methane and all kinds of greenhouse gases that are every bit as destructive as what comes out of the tailpipe of our automobiles. So that will be the focus of our program. But I had a very entertaining conversation with Al Gore, and I say Al Gore and I go back a long ways. In fact, the first time I met Al Gore was in the early 90s. He'd just become vice president, and his job was to be overseeing the collaboration between Russia and the United States in space, as well as the monitoring and counting and hopefully demilitarizing of their nuclear arsenal, because the Soviet Union had just broken up. If you'll recall, the early 90s were a period of celebration for America. It was a period where the population in Russia actually shrank. The chaos and the economic downturn that took place in post-Soviet Russia was a horrible situation. And there was serious concern that the nukes in Russia would end up on the open market. There's some speculation that there may be one or two rogue nukes that have actually made it out of Russia, but apparently there's only one way to find out, and we don't need to discuss that today. That was his job, and I was interviewing him. We were doing this investigation on how the chaos in Russia and the corruption, the rampant corruption in Russia, meant that our space program collaboration with Russia was this huge boondoggle for the Russians. Basically, they were extracting cash as a kind of an extortion scheme. We pay for their space program and pay politicians to basically allow all of this to take place, and in return, we get to defuse their nukes. Which, if you phrase that, whether in Russian or English, that can sound suspiciously like, give us $400 billion or we'll sell our nukes to the Saudis. And we were trying to distinguish between whether this was, in fact, extortion or if Al Gore was doing something that, you know, had a serious, if the U.S. was in control of this or not in control of this. But Al Gore, of course, who knew me from public radio, and at that time in the early 90s, you know, people in public radio were viewed as very nice and, you know, calm, intelligent people who would never say anything that would be rude or possibly confront someone on what it was they were doing, particularly a Democrat. And so Mr. Vice President Gore came into this interview not expecting the experience that he ultimately had. We had done a lot of research on the Russian space program and the extent to which the U.S. was really being held over a barrel, and we had a lot of statistics, and the interview was going to be very confrontational because I think Gore was under the misapprehension that simply being the guy who is in charge of taking care of the Russian nukes was a great thing for a vice president to do, because the tradition of vice presidents was to kind of sit there and shut up, right? Dick Cheney, of course, changed that. that, again, is another story. But at the time, Gore was a very active vice president comparatively. I mean, he was nothing like Cheney, but these were his proud portfolios of responsibility, and I was going to take him down. And it was the single worst moment in my life in television, and I'll tell you for this reason. As you can see, I mean, I drove here from Boston. I'm my typical sort of Bernie Sanders rumpled-looking self. Indeed, when I started in television at ABC in the early 90s, I didn't have what we would call a coherent fashion sense. I just would put on, I mean, the buttons on collared shirts were, I thought, supposed to strangle you. My shirts didn't quite fit. I was doing very well as a reporter, and I was having a great time. But I was not your classic ABC reporter. And Rune Arledge, who hired me at the time, was very concerned that I show up at these shoots and not look like someone who had been, as opposed to wearing laundered clothes, actually having been through the laundry himself. And I was, you know, a slow learner as far as this was concerned. And my hair at the time was, you know, sort of needed a haircut, kind of like now, only a little bit worse. And I was staying at a hotel in Washington, D.C., the same hotel, as it turns out, that Elliot Spitzer used for his liaisons much later, the Mayflower. And I decided I need a haircut. And so instead of going to, you know, a serious hair cutter for television, I mean, I was used to, I mean, I'm a guy in radio, right? You put a bowl over your head and you cut your hair, right? That's what, you know, I was from the Pacific Northwest. That's where I got my start in public radio. So, you know, you let your hair grow. What? Cut your hair? Why? What's the point of that? I didn't necessarily know what I was getting into, and I just said, I'll go into the basement where there's a barber down in the Mayflower Hotel. And this lovely Argentinian woman did the most bizarre cut of my hair. And I went directly from that haircut to the shoot with Al Gore. I rolled into the room. Al Gore hadn't arrived yet. My producer took one look at me and said, "What in the hell have you done to your hair?" She was Leslie Coburn, who's Emmy Award-winning 60 Minutes producer. She was working for ABC at the time, and we were doing this story together. And I said, "I don't know, what's the problem?" And she put my picture on camera and showed me the monitor and said, "You look like somebody attacked you. Where are you? It was a little, you know, it wasn't symmetrical, and I didn't really pay much attention when I was getting this haircut. So here I am, my producer is angry as hell at me for getting this like terrible haircut. She had to basically position the camera so that my head kind of wasn't in the shot, if you know what I mean, which is not typically what you do in television. Diane Sawyer, you'll notice, has her head in almost every shot. So that was an anxiety. And then Al Gore comes in, and I start to interview him, and really hitting him hard on this subject of, is this a space program, or is this a nuclear extortion scheme? And we had the goods on it, and Vice President Gore was, you know, oh my God! He was absolutely infuriated by the whole thing. And it was a great story, and it was actually very important. And things changed as a result of the story that we did for the magazine show at ABC News. But the upshot was that I went to NBC later on in 1996. And I had a cable show called Edgewise, which is a weekly cable show, which was just a great experience. It didn't last terribly long, but it was a great experiment in cable television. It would have been great if it stayed on the air, but it didn't. And one week, we decided, and this was years after my encounter with Al Gore, we had an editorial meeting. We said, let's do a program on, you know, some sort of political theme. And the idea was, let's get Al Gore. That would be great. It was in the middle of the Clinton years. It was 96, 97. The election, it was actually 96, was in the middle of the election campaign, and the idea was, let's get Vice President Gore. And my staff went out to get him, and NBC News at the time thought this would be a great thing, so they put their serious resources to book Al Gore for this program. And I remember my executive producer came to me. His name is R.J. Cutler. He produced The War Room, the movie The War Room, and is now a very successful a filmmaker out in L.A. He was the producer of my program at the time, a dear friend. And he came to me, he sat me down in my office, he said, what the hell is the deal with Al Gore and you? And I said, what are you talking about? We called up, and we were doing great, and he was going to come on the program, and somebody asked, who's the host of the show? And we said your name, and all of a sudden they stopped calling us. They stopped calling us back. They said, absolutely, under no circumstances will Vice President Gore ever be in the same room with the John Hockenberry ever again. And did you date one of his daughters or something? No. It was a little story that we did in the beginning of the Clinton administration that, let's just shall we say, had some consequences. If you're a journalist in the business as long as I've been in this business, such things are more valuable to you often than Emmys and Peabody's. The idea that you can have a story that will have such an impact on a person who you actually do respect and result in an actual change in policy, that is important, because I think the nuclear program is important, and it's important for the United States to be controlling it, not the Russians at that time. And the other person who wants absolutely nothing to do with me and will truly never speak to me again is Ray Kelly, the head of the NYPD under Michael Bloomberg. And that's because of a hidden camera investigation that I did. And indeed, the communications people for Ray Kelly at the NYPD had assured Commissioner Kelly that, oh, this will be a great interview because John Hockenberry used to work for public radio for 12 years. I mean, he's very reasonable and completely, you know, intelligent. And the message to Ray Kelly was, you don't have to worry about these softy public radio journalists because they'll never ask anything that's unfair. And what you realize is that to a New York politician, unfair is asking any question that they don't want to answer. It's not actually unfair. It's just fair is basically talking about the Mets, apparently, or the Yankees. Yankees with Giuliani. He doesn't know anything about the Mets. Anyway, you can imagine the situation, but Ray Kelly won't talk to me to this day. A badge of honor, I assure you, greater than any Peabody or Emmy that I have, because it was an important story about police brutality and civilian complaints, a story that still we are talking about today in New York and all over the United States. Well, years go by. Al Gore does his movie, An Inconvenient Truth, and he does a big rollout premiere of Inconvenient Truth in New York City at the Town Hall, where Garrison Keillor often does his shows. It's a great old venue in Midtown Manhattan, a wonderful place, has a great, great history. I actually think Bernie Sanders was probably there in the 1960s doing anarchist rallies. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. And Al Gore was going to be on stage. I was the moderator for the whole thing. And his producer, William Bender, was going to be there. Larry David's wife, who is a big sort of climate change person who was big on this subject, they're since divorced. I don't think it was over climate change that Larry David divorced her. But she out in Beverly Hills, it was funny, she was very, very sincere about climate change, but very different from a Vermonter. A classic sort of Beverly Hills person, she would say things like, we can do this. Just don't leave your computer on. You know, that was like, for her, a really important thing to do to affect global warming. In Beverly Hills, they have a slightly different view of what you can actually do in your life to change things than the rest of us. But anyway, she was a part of this coalition that made this film happen, and so she was on stage, and there were a couple other... Oh, and Jim Hansen, the scientist, who figures very prominently in An Inconvenient Truth. He was on stage. And Al Gore. And I had been asked to be the moderator of this. I can't remember whom by, but the organizers kept saying, all right, it's great. They would talk to me about blocking. They would call up, and I would say, you've talked with Al Gore about this, right? I mean, he knows that I'm the moderator, right? You know, because remembering my experience. And they say, oh, yeah, well, there's no problem. And I said, I mean, you've asked. I mean, you've actually gone up to him and said, you know, John Hockenberry is the moderator, right? And they said, oh, yeah, but, yeah, no problem. I mean, I still just didn't know if they actually had. I had this suspicion that I was the only one that really knew that this could conceivably be a problem. And the day of the event happened, and we're all in the green room. And, of course, Tipper and Al arrive last. And one of their daughters were there, too. I can't remember which one. I think the oldest. And they were all expected. And the guys with the little IFB things, you know, the Secret Service dudes came in and swept the room, and the dogs come in and all that stuff. And I'm sitting there. And I'm going, man, this could get really ugly. I mean, if Gore comes in here and sees me and, you know, he's got, like, armed guards with him, I mean, I could get carried out the door and thrown in a paddy wagon or something. I mean, and so I'm sitting there, I'm having a great conversation with the producer, having a great conversation with Jim Hansen, and there were some hors d'oeuvres, and it was very well catered, and classic Hollywood premiere. And in comes Al and Tipper and their daughter. And Al comes right up to me and says, so you're moderating this. And of course, he hadn't been told. No one had said word one to him. And I was like, yeah. I thought I'd humiliate you on stage in front of... the people of New York City. You got a problem with that? I mean, we joked. He was very, very magnanimous. It was great. We had a wonderful time on stage. And from that moment on, we've been really dear friends and, if not collaborators, certainly people who value this ongoing conversation about how climate change is understood by Americans. And so in the conversation today, he got on the phone. He was via satellite, and I said, "As I live and breathe, Vice President Al Gore, how you doing, John? How's it going? Any surprises for me today?" So he remembered everything. It was great to have that long experience. I think as a journalist, you yearn to have an authentic relationship with someone that develops mutual respect, and that he knows that I'm not afraid to ask him a tough question. And so he's going to be thoughtful about his answers. And it was a terrific interview, and I encourage you to listen to the program. He's very, very optimistic. It's funny because Gore, who really led the way in introducing people to think about climate change and global warming with Inconvenient Truth and the... how many of you know what Inconvenient Truth came from? What, say again? What did the movie An Inconvenient Truth come from? It stemmed from, if you've seen it. Well, no, it stemmed from this, when Al Gore lost won the election in 2000, and discovered that in the fine print, he won the election, but he couldn't actually be president, which, you know, makes him a bit of a historical figure. Maybe, you know, in a few decades, the hottest ticket on Broadway, instead of Hamilton, it'll be Gore. I highly recommend, by the way, this show, Hamilton. It's so interesting about what America is really about versus the myths that we're taught in school. And it's not an angry show. It's a really beautiful, wonderful, wonderful program. And in some ways, Al Gore lives in this curious place in American history where he was sort of tossed aside and yet, kind of like Jimmy Carter, found his way back into the center of the American discourse. And anyway, Al Gore lost and, you know, was sort of repudiated by the Democratic Party. I mean, the Clintons, who are so thrillingly warm and magnanimous, often just kind of said, well, you know, Al, you lost your own state. You know, I don't know, I can't help you, you know. Certainly wasn't my impeachment that had anything to do with your problems, I'm sure. You know, Al was kind of all by himself. He went back to Knoxville, and you know, he didn't really want to write a book about, you know, how I screwed up, why I'm not president. I mean, you know, who would want to write about that? You know, living in the lockbox. I guess that could have been one of his... I hate the Macarena, you know, the kinds of things that he could write about. And he really recalled the moment at the convention in 96 when he told the story of his sister dying of lung cancer and took on the tobacco lobby. And that was one of the things that he helped do during the Clinton administration, one of his great successes, and thought to himself, you know, there's a similar lobby that has an entrenched set of interests in our consumption of energy and the ways in which we consume food, the ways in which we use transportation, and the psychological ways in which we convince ourselves that everything about industrial growth is good and nothing about industrial plateaus or sustainable economic cycles that don't constantly rise all the time and aren't dependent upon constant economic growth, that those things are all bad. He said, no, in fact, there's a lobby that wants us to believe that, but it's not necessarily true. And so he decided he would go after that lobby, and what he did was, if you're as much of a dork as Al Gore is, and he really is kind of a dork. I mean, that's why he didn't have an overwhelming victory over George Bush in 2000. It's because he was he said things like, I invented the internet, and he loved like the guys who started Google, and he hung out in Silicon Valley, and he just was a techie before anyone even cared about that culture. You know, people understood tech as a kind of stock market phenomenon in 2000, but they didn't understand it the way he understood it as a cultural phenomenon. So if you're a dork like Al Gore, you do a PowerPoint presentation, right? And that's where An Inconvenient Truth came from. Al Gore's PowerPoint presentation that he would take around to Kiwanis clubs and Rotary clubs and church groups and, you know, anyone who would have him. And he refined it, and he did it in front of small audiences. He did it in front of big audiences. He just said, I care about this. I'm going to get this message across. I believe that this message will break through eventually. And the Hollywood producers who decided that this could be a movie, you know, it wasn't like somebody went up to in an elevator and said, okay, here's an incredible idea for a movie, okay? Discredited vice president, really boring dude, PowerPoint presentation, end of the earth. Huh? You know, that's not how Inconvenient Truth got made. Inconvenient Truth got made because, you know, people who, I mean, if you've ever spent any time in L.A. and in Hollywood, you know, everyone in America loves... probably not a whole lot of people in Vermont, but basically American culture is obsessed with celebrities, right? I mean, can we agree on that? The one thing that's great about coming to Vermont, though, is that I do understand that if next Wednesday the conversation was with Kim Kardashian, there would be fewer people in this room. It's probably one of the only places on Earth where that would be the case right now. So I feel very comfortable and really cool here in Vermont. Yeah. But in general, Americans love celebrity. And the one problem in L.A. is that they're all celebrities. So who do they love? Well, they love D.C. politicians. And my future colleague down here, who's from D.C., can attest to the fact that Hollywood actors and directors love hanging out with presidents and political operatives and that sort of thing. So Al Gore, to people in Hollywood, was like a hot ticket. You know, the rest of America is sort of like, you know. But to Hollywood, he was like a hot ticket. So they would go to this PowerPoint presentation, and it was, by the time the Hollywood producers saw it, it was, I mean, he had it down, and audiences were like eating out of his hand, and it was, as you saw in the movie, it was an extraordinarily compelling message, and it was this great central character, Jim Hansen, who brought truth to the government and got handed his head during the Reagan and Bush administrations, and to a certain extent, during the Clinton administration. The new Democrats, represented by Bill and Hillary Clinton, were a little skeptical of the political value in embracing climate change as a political issue. Well, Al Gore had this down. They said this could be a movie. They put it together. The first thing they did was not allow Al Gore to write it, which was good. It was a good move, which he understood was a good move. It became a movie, and of course, the rest is history, and he won the Nobel Prize. Here's a guy who spent his entire life in politics, traditional politics, where a big family can have a huge influence. Political family is a four-letter word, Gore, in his case, G-O-R-E. He knows about other big political, the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, he understands how the game is played. And what Inconvenient Truth is about, if you go back and see it, and if you look at what's happened since, and that's what Climate of Doubt is really about, is that politics results in social change in America not because of legislation necessarily, not because of the acts of presidents and members of Congress. It happens because there's a psychological shift in the culture, and something generates that, whether it's Uncle Tom's Cabin in the case of emancipation that turned the abolitionist movement from essentially a domestic terrorism movement in the United States to a, wow, that's a horrible experience that's going on under our nose, this idea of man's inhumanity to man, which is what slavery was all about. And that psychological shift, that pivot point where people begin to think differently about an event that's happening over and over in American life, that's where politics, sensing that change, the institutions of government, the wheels turn, and all of a sudden you have, in the case of the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Act, 30 years ago, the Civil Rights Act in 1965, the Voting Rights Act in 1965, the Immigration Act, which got rid of the original quotas, which denied access to Africans, oddly enough. Africans couldn't come here as immigrants, but they could be thrown in ships in the 1700s and come here as slaves. Lyndon B. Johnson changed that. Another part of the legacy of LBJ that's overwhelmed by the Vietnam War. All of that change was possible, partly because of Johnson's astute ability to execute politics in Washington, D.C., but it was also because he understood a change was happening at the ground and grassroots level. Gore understood that as well. And so Inconvenient Truth sparked a discourse and a conversation that suddenly made its way into mainstream American politics. And that's when the K Street operatives got involved, and the fossil fuel lobby and the Koch brothers and others decided we can't say the end of the world is a good idea as our argument here. We can't actually say that destroying the environment is something we want to do or that our economy depends on it. So what do we do? How do we fight this? You don't fight this by countering the scientists, yes, humans are causing global warming, with a no, humans aren't causing global warming. You fight it with a much more powerful word, which is what? What? That, well, yeah, it, that, but the word is maybe. You know, it's like you say yes, well, I say maybe. And what do you do when you say maybe? You want to study it more, preferably forever, for centuries, in fact, to never make a decision. And people who, in the scientific community, when 99% or 95% of scientists agree on a scientific result, say that the polio vaccine is actually an appropriate treatment for polio, which was a scourge in the 1930s and 40s. It's the reason why we've already had a disabled American president, FDR, long before we had an African-American president. Polio vaccine works. 99% of medical science buys into that. Antibiotics work. 99% of scientists and medical practitioners and researchers buy into that. We call that, in the scientific world, consensus. Now, if you're a political operative that wants to fight consensus, you characterize that as zealotry. So, whoa, those people are kind of like fundamentalists. They like think that humans are destroying the earth. Well, first of all, how could humans possibly do that? And there are scientists who think that this is not true. And here are these scientists over here who are trying to suppress the views of these other scientists. Wow, that doesn't sound like democracy. That doesn't even sound like freedom of speech. All of a sudden, these political operatives who are trying to deny climate change as a legitimate political issue have turned into these like ACLU advocates of free speech. So suddenly what you see is people like Congressman Sensenbrenner from Ohio and groups like the Center for Prosperity, which is one of the main groups that we focused on in the Frontline documentary, are basically setting up, wow, these climate change people, these environmentalists are actually a lobby of zealots who have foisted upon you this idea of climate change so that they can actually pursue their narrow special interests. And in fact, the climate change deniers in the 2008 election, and particularly in the 2012 election, produced all kinds of theories that data was manipulated, when in fact it was simply peer-reviewed and modified to reflect new and different experiments. Fox News and reporters and investigators who had in their mind the idea that we are going to, again, sow doubt, produced reports that said they've manipulated the data. Well, it's a rigged game. How can we trust these people? And they would also say that climate change is actually a scam. These scientists, how much do they get paid at these universities? Not a whole lot. So how do they get more money? Well, they invent a catastrophe and get taxpayer money to pay for their research. Now, never mind the fact that the amount of money that the government funds for basic research could essentially pay for, the number of tires that the Pentagon uses, in a month, maybe. I mean, the scale of what constitutes federal taxpayer dollars for research, which has declined significantly since the middle of the 20th century, which is another fascinating and very interesting story. The idea that scientists we're going to get together and go, hey, we'll fool them all into thinking that global warming is happening. We'll get Al Gore to be our front person, and then we'll just sit back and watch the dollars roll in for our grants. I mean, better schemes for getting federal dollars have been invented. My favorite, of course, is the one that the two psychiatrists from California who were hired by the Pentagon to assure that the enhanced interrogation procedures of the CIA that were used during interrogations of people on black sites and at places like Abu Ghraib were medically okay. And they helped to design these torture procedures. These two psychiatrists, medically accredited psychiatrists, got, does anyone know how much they got? It came out in the Dianne Feinstein torture report in Congress. Anybody have any idea how much money these two psychiatrists shared in government contracts for designing the torture procedures for the Iraq War? How much? $81 million. Yeah. So there are better schemes for getting federal research dollars, but nevertheless, this was plausible. This was very, very plausible. And suddenly, the polling numbers that at the end of the Clinton administration and the beginning of the middle of the George Bush administration, basically the period from 2000 to 2006, 2007, the polling numbers were rising consistently, that there was an understanding that something was happening with the climate, that there was global warming, that greenhouse gases were being produced by automobiles and power plants, and of course the acid rain issue that's affected all of your fisheries here in the Northeast were clearly linked to power plants in the Midwest. So there was an understanding that, wow, yeah, the fish disappeared. That the polls were like running like 80% people believed that climate change was a serious issue and that it was human caused. Acid rain was one indication. The other big story that people had familiarity with from the 1970s was the CFC story. You know what that is? Chlorofluorocarbons, where chlorofluorocarbons were perceived as destroying the ozone layer, which resulted in increased skin cancer. That was something. People put, sunscreen on because they understand humans can have large-scale impacts on the climate. So these were already internalized news stories and phenomena that people understood and that they accepted and that there was no debate about, absolutely no debate about. And so the 80% poll numbers that climate change is real and it's something we have to deal with, these operatives went to work. And by 2012, by the 2012 election, and really by they were aided significantly in the 2008 election because the economic downturn allowed climate deniers to go, whoa, unemployment is rising like crazy, and these insane Democrats are proposing something that's going to get rid of jobs by closing down factories and causing us to step away from our economic growth strategy and assumptions in the economy that require increased sources of energy. You'll remember drill, baby, drill in 2000. From George W. Bush, that was repeated by Sarah Palin in 2008. So in 2008, the deniers were doing a very, very good job of getting their messages across, but it didn't really show up in the numbers at that time. But once the unemployment rate hit 10% in 2010, really the peak of the unemployment rate, which was in 2009, 2010, then suddenly the numbers started to come down. And then you see within Congress a grassroots effort using the tactics of this doubt strategy, where it's like, this scientist over here still wants to study, but this scientist over here has already decided that it's true. I mean, are you going to choose this narrow-minded scientist who believes he doesn't have to study it anymore, even though he's won a Nobel Prize in chemistry? Or are you going to choose this open-minded scientist who wants to study more and more and longer? And is it going to close his mind by calling, 1 + 1 = 2 a certified fact of mathematics, or in this case, climate science? And that began to move the needle. So by 2012, the people who believed that climate change was caused by humans and was an urgent matter of national policy had declined to below 50%. Below 50%, and nothing had changed. In fact, if anything, the temperatures continued to rise. And so all during the election, I was producing this report, and we decided that our strategy in producing this report was going to be, we don't want to argue with them. We don't want these interviews to be arguments. What we want to do is basically hear from the believers. We want to hear their strategy. And so Nightline got me, I think, perhaps because Al Gore told him what a pain in the ass I was, and that it would take a different kind of interview than the Steve Croft sort of Mike Wallace gotcha interview to do this. You'd have to do something that basically said, and then what did you do? Wow. So you started at 80% of people believing one way, and how much did you spend? And it's below 40. Well, these guys were so dying to tell their story. I mean, they were so proud of what they had done. I mean, these K Street guys were going, well, John, it's even better than that, pal. It's even better than that, all right? You know, we got the people, and this is one of the sound bites in the Frontline piece, we got the people in, I mean, this is the best part. It's like the people where the decline was the sharpest, okay, it was like coastal communities. Isn't that great? I mean, that just shows that you can really, and to see that level of cynicism and the idea that, you had a strategy to truly move the political needle on something that they understood was, I mean, the science didn't matter to them at all. The truth or falsity didn't matter. I remember the most powerful soundbite in the whole Frontline piece to me was when I asked one of these lobbyists at the Center for Prosperity, I said, I mean, what if it's true? I mean, what if it's all sort of true? What if in 50 years, the sea level rise is covering all these communities and everything that you've said that there's doubt about, there's absolute certainty about, and you can see it everywhere you look. What would we say that? What would your reaction be? And it was funny, because you go through the cycle of what he could say, from high probability to low probability. You could say nothing, which these guys don't say nothing. They're not the no comment guys. They love to talk. They really love to talk because they're behind the scenes. They could say, we are dreadfully sorry. We never intended to do something that would have such catastrophic consequences to our society. Please forgive us. Our intentions were good. Low percentage shot on that one. Not a not a high probability that would be what he would say. But I really had no idea what his answer was going to be. And his answer was, he'd say, we tried. Didn't work out. That's what he'd say. And I wanted to follow up, and I kind of said, you know what? Just let that sumbitch just sit right out there. I mean, that says it all. I can't top that, and there's nothing to say to that. I mean, that it says it perfectly. The truth really doesn't matter. All that matters is to get ignorant people to basically do your bidding. You know, in the century that most of us spent most of our lives in here in this room, not you guys, you know, I mean, they had a name for it. They called it, strategic, communication strategy, using Twitter and social media and all kinds of things that they were, hugely proud of. But of course, we know what it's called. It's just propaganda. I mean, these guys didn't invent it. Germany did a really good job with this, convincing everyone that the Jews were the cause of all the consequences of the Versailles Treaty after World War I. Stalin convinced everyone that counter-revolutionaries were the cause of every bad thing that was going on in the Soviet Union, and he killed, probably double the number of people that Hitler killed, all told, during the Cold War. That's not to equate what they did with what these climate deniers are doing, but the techniques are the same. The techniques are absolutely the same, and in some ways, social media enables a sharper message to penetrate much more quickly, and you can flood the zone on, the night before an election and have a real impact. I will say one last thing and then open it to questions, because I'm sure you have questions about anything, the political campaign. I'm doing the program out of Vermont Public Radio tomorrow, and we'll be talking about your senator here, Mr. Sanders. And of course, any of the subjects that I cover on The Takeaway, what's going on in the Middle East, or anything that I've done throughout my career, including the two sets of twins that you all gasped at. I discover this two sets of twins and my little surprise youngest, Ajax, who if you have two sets of twins and then a surprise fifth kid comes along, you don't name him Joe or you don't name her, Sally. You go for a huge name, it's got to be something with some bang. And so somebody was asking me last night, what were your options for the name? So they asked me, why Ajax? And I said precisely that you don't name your fifth kid, Joe. But it was Ajax, Tycho, or Copernicus. And if he was a girl, it was going to be Clementine or Ptolemy. The PT, I just love that kind of thing. Probably only mean that she would have a terrible spelling deficit for the rest of her life if that had been the case. But anyway, Ajax loves his name, and when I told my mother that I'd named our fifth child, she had five children as well, Ajax. And of course, I'm, classical scholar, literary dweeb, and Ajax is the leader of the Achaeans, but to my mother, it's, oh, for heaven's sakes, you named him after a soap. And then I talk to really young people, and I say my youngest's name is Ajax, and they go, oh, you mean like the computer graphics language? Yeah. What's great is that he can wear a T-shirt that says "Stronger Than Dirt," which is the Ajax Mad Men slogan of the 1960s. But it's a great T-shirt anyway. So anyway, the the final point here, before we can talk about anything else that I might be covering on the show tomorrow, the show Climate of Doubt came out, and again, we were, you know, editing, and you never know whether people are going to take, you know, how controversial this is going to be, and this is the middle of the election campaign. At Frontline, you want to have influence, but there's always concern. I mean, at any television operation, it's like, you know, if you're not doing, stuff that's so urgent, and at the networks, I mean, if you're not doing, you know, To Catch a Predator, right? If it gets too smart, you know, people get, no one's going to follow this. It's not going to be clear. Who wants to pay attention to climate change? Are you sure this is important? I mean, it's kind of, even at Frontline, they have some of these same kinds of, I mean, there was a commitment to the broadcast, but there's always kind of concerns and, you know, butterflies in the stomach. Did we pick something that people are going to watch? Well, in this particular case, there was no such concern because Climate of Doubt aired the day after Sandy hit New York. And it drew one of the hugest audiences of Frontline. And all of a sudden, like, climate change was, in the last days of the election, you know, it happened on Halloween, basically, 3 years ago. And it's like the subject. You know, never in public radio have I ever, like, done a story that's like, the subject. It's as though I became a Kardashian, you know. It's like suddenly there's like my phone is ringing off the hook. Oh, can you do an interview? Yeah, you want to talk about how'd you figure that stuff out? I mean, it's like, whoa, did you know Sandy was coming? You know, I said, yeah, pretty much, you know. And it was just great to see how this tension between the myths that we can create in our political discourse and the power of nature. Nature wins in the end, and you don't want to set yourself up in that battle. And that ultimately is what Climate of Doubt was about. So thank you very much, and let's have some questions. We interact on the takeaway, so there are microphones down here if you want to come down and ask your question. But if you just want to sit there, I'll repeat the question so everyone can hear, right here in the middle. Yes. What makes Al Gore be so hopeful about climate change when, you know, you've got both candidates, and I'll just add to your question, you've got both candidates from Florida, for instance, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, claiming that climate change is not really a significant issue even today in the state that has the largest concern about sea level rise in the United States. You know, how can you be hopeful, Al? Are you being a dweeb again? And Al says, you know, he really, you know, has stayed in touch with this, and he really feels, and I think a lot of people do, and it's not just on climate change where this is the case. It's also the case in race and in stories like phenomena like police brutality. There's been a real change at the grassroots level. I mean, there's been a real fundamental recognition in huge communities, both around the globe and in the United States. I mean, there are plenty of places where nobody wants to talk about climate change, but they're the outliers. I mean, the shift has happened, and there are places where people just want to move on. And, all right, what are we going to do to adapt? There are huge initiatives to, and I talked about this at the very beginning, the adaptation issue. I mean, if Gore was worried about something, it was the idea that the message was if we don't stop the warming of the Earth or limit it to 3 degrees, 5 degrees by the end of the century, it's hopeless. If there was anything that Al Gore was concerned about in Inconvenient Truth, it was that was going to shut people down. And the thing that so surprised him and made him so hopeful is that, indeed, human history is the history of adapting to climate change from the Ice Age straight forward. And so people are innately ready to adapt to even significant self-inflicted climatological wounds. And so people are adapting in all kinds of ways, whether it's coastal communities changing their insurance rates, being more responsible about evacuation procedures, changing zoning, essentially allowing market reality to set prices for real estate in coastal communities so that there isn't this huge subsidy of people live in completely ridiculous areas in hurricane zones. That's all changing. And then bigger things are happening. In Bangladesh, for instance, ways in which they're working to mitigate atmospheric problems in Bangladesh. China is adopting cap and trade. And if you'll remember, as recently as 5 years ago, China and the industrialized nations of the world were arguing about whether China and India get to pollute just like the United States did before we all became enlightened, and that somehow the U.S. was going to use climate change to constrain the development of India and China's industrial economies, and that they wanted their chance to do all the stupid things that the United States did, and that it was unfair of us to deny them that. Well, number one, China's economy grew faster even than they expected, and they understood that they had the surplus capital to support innovative growth in mitigation technology. And indeed, China is a leader in the production of solar cells right now and is rapidly becoming a leader in sustainable wind turbine technology. The U.S. actually leads right there now, but Beijing is very serious about its atmospheric problems because of what happens in cities like Beijing and other cities in the south, where you have 200 days a year where it's unbreathable air. So Gore is very, very optimistic about people's both recognition and taking action to mitigate and adapt, and to, at the community level, create a kind of identity of citizenship that relates to our environmental impact. Carbon footprint came out of an inconvenient truth. It was a scientific term before that. But people have expanded their sense of their environmental impact, personal environmental impact, way beyond carbon footprint. And that's a very, very positive thing. There are plenty of people who aren't doing it, but that's a positive thing. Right here.
The one thing you haven't mentioned tonight is the food chain. 6 or 7 billion people, maybe going to 10. A lot of cows, a lot of chickens, a lot of pigs, a lot of methane, a lot of pollution. I don't know what percentage that is of the problem, but I'm surprised in the whole talk tonight it hasn't come up.
Well, the question was, why hasn't the food chain and the way we do industrial agriculture in the world and the understanding that that contributes greatly to greenhouse gases in that the production of animal protein, chickens, pigs, and beef produces all kinds of methane, which methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. Why hasn't that come up tonight? Well, the only reason that hasn't come up tonight is because Climate of Doubt was about something fundamentally different. And as again, I said, I'm not a beat reporter on this subject, but I have, on the Takeaway, done a lot of stories about precisely this subject. And in fact, story that we did last week was all about this question of food waste. Actually, we did it this week. This question of a progressive notion of food waste in America, particularly because anybody have an idea of how much food is actually just sort of thrown away, totally edible food in the United States? What percentage? 40%. Right. That's right. 40%. And much of it ends up in landfills, and in landfills it decomposes and produces precisely the greenhouse gases that you're talking about, methane and carbon dioxide. And so the traditional model for dealing with food waste was, well, let's give it to the hungry people. And a more progressive and efficient notion of how we should deal with food waste is to recognize that there's something fundamentally wrong with our agricultural production system if it is producing a product, 40% of which ends up in the garbage. If 40% of your computer was something that you never use, actually, probably 40% of your computer, actually 90% of your computer is something you don't use. I mean, I forget, we're in America. This is, waste is what we do. You know, that's an argument for rethinking what's going on in industrial agriculture. And, you know, whether it's the traditional vegetarian and vegan argument that if you deal with vegetable protein, it is much more efficient and has a diminished impact on the land, both in terms of soil preservation and in terms of precisely these kinds of things that you're talking about. That's starting to happen. It's starting to be understood that our approach to food is an environmental issue, not simply an issue that relates to our hearts and our cholesterol rates and our health. That it is part of this global, and I mean global in the sense of our complete understanding of our relationship with the environment. And to pretend as though, hey, meat is food. What are you giving me this grief about? Come on, you know. To understand that there's a different way of looking at all the things that we consume and that each one of them has an impact. That if you can look at raspberries in your grocery and see, wow, I'm paying for airfare from Chile, you know. If you're understanding that, suddenly you're having a much more enlightened sense of what it is you do in the world. And we've done a lot of stories on the takeaway. It wasn't the subject of the front line, but it's a very big deal right now, and it's going to be much more important. You know, how many of you shop at Whole Foods? I don't know if there are any Whole Foods in Vermont. Yeah, probably none of you do. But the sort of, have any of you ever been in Whole Foods? Ever? Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a grocery store meets Vegas massage parlor, Vegas strip joint, right? It's food porn. I mean, it's just perfect tomatoes. It's like asparagus as Barbie, right? Nobody looks like that, you know. But you buy these asparaguses, and you love them. But if you think hard about, and you don't look at the prices on the Whole Food prices for their produce, you realize that for them to get all that perfect-looking produce in all of those stores requires that somebody is throwing away a lot of tomatoes that have, like, smudges on them or aren't perfectly round. This is Vermont. You're all obsessed with tomatoes, right? Right? I mean, you have gardens, right? Everybody has gardens. It's illegal not to have a garden, actually, right? You're not allowed to own a gun unless you have a garden in Vermont. It's something like that, yeah? In New Hampshire, actually, you can't have a garden unless you have a gun. I use that to keep the two states distinct. I'm from New York, so it's all just sort of a blur up here, right, for me. Tomatoes, if you grow them, they're ugly. I mean, they're misshapen. They're delicious. We love them, you know. It's why the Italians put most of their tomatoes in sauces. Because, bread looks beautiful to an Italian. Tomatoes, they're not beautiful. Taste those things, you know. But at Whole Foods, tomatoes are like, oh, they're gorgeous. They're red orbs, you know. That taste like water. Here's $10. I'll take one, you know. It's America, right? Question here. There's a responsible Vermonter coming down to the mic. Yeah, he's been to a town meeting or two. Yeah, it'll be on in a moment, I think. Yep. There's a mic coming to you. The backup wireless mic.
Okay, here, you have that one. That, now here.
What's your name, sir?
We have one of these at our retirement center.
What's your name?
They're directional. I'm John Howell.
John Howell. Ladies and gentlemen, the John Howell Show.
Like this. Okay.
Please.
You have to talk like in this.
Yep, that's good.
Okay. What you've been saying tonight is a soup to my soul. My first introduction was February 25th, 2007, when Al Gore got the Academy Award for the Inconvenient Truth, and I went out and saw it and said, what's going on here? And I remember thinking at the end of it, if even half of this truth, I don't know whether he's right or not, but even half of this truth, the human race is in deep doo-doo. Okay? I came from North Carolina a year ago to Vermont. I attended a church there, but most of my social life was around the church. My wife had grown up in when it was 400 or 500 members. It was now over 2,000 members, and there were only two people. I didn't know everybody out of the 2,000, but I'd been a member for 50 years. Only two people would let me even talk to them about the subject.
What city in North Carolina?
Beg pardon?
What city in North Carolina?
Charlotte, North Carolina.
Charlotte, yeah.
And I don't want to give the impression that all North Carolina is the same, not the same way. Not all Vermont is the same, okay? But it was the most frustrating 7 years of my life trying to tell people what I had learned, what I had studied, and it would break up people from a meeting and ask the host, where's my coat? I need to go. So it's been wonderful to hear you tonight. My question.
Well, you're among friends, so.
Yes.
We're glad you made it out. Although I've spent a lot of time in North Carolina, and there are very progressive. There's a real battle going on in North Carolina, especially
around the college centers.
Yeah.
They're aware of it. My big question to you, or what I'd like to hear you say, is what are your hopes, your thoughts about the meeting that's coming up in Paris in December?
Yeah, the Paris meeting on climate change will get world leaders together, and Al Gore is very positive about this meeting coming up in Paris. And unlike what happened in Kyoto, which was very abstract and really illustrated more than anything else the kind of north-south dimension of the climate change issue, in the sense that the southern nations were going to have to bear the burden of the impacts while the northern nations were pretty much the consumers of energy and emitters of greenhouse gases, and that their solution was to simply subsidize the consequences to the people in the South. That was all they were prepared to do. Changing their behavior was going to be a very, very difficult objective. And as progressive as Kyoto was, and we should remember that the U.S. was not a signatory of the Kyoto Protocols, it was a very abstract document, and it led directly to the collision in Copenhagen, where there couldn't be agreement on mitigation targets. And you'll recall the leader of the Marshall Islands was the only person who could get China and India and the United States to sit down at the table and actually discuss what the impacts were going to be, and it still ended in a stalemate. Paris is going to be very, very different because everyone is bringing to the meeting their plan. So you can't come to the meeting unless you have a plan. So you have to have already pre-committed to your national contribution to what it's going to take to either mitigate or adapt to climate change and its impacts. And then part of the meeting will be there will be an attempt to calculate if everybody does what they say they're going to do, this is how close we're going to get to the goal we really want to meet globally. And then the discussion will be over, all right, here's the gap, here's how we close it, you take this part of the gap, you take this part of the gap. I mean, it's going to be much more practical than it's ever been, and the modalities for even talking about this have become much more a trade of, all right, if you do this, I can do this. Ah, I see you're really good at this. Well, I can do this. Oh, you're going to have some problems down here. We can compensate you over here. I'm not saying it's going to be some kind of utopian, everyone gathers in the city of light and world peace is achieved. But it certainly, I think, is a much more hopeful prospect in Paris than we've seen for a long time. And I think what comes out of Paris for the first time will filter farther down to individual people's lives. You'll be able to see how you're a part of the national plan. Now, you're going to also hear about a lot of stuff about how so we're going to let these French people decide what we're doing here in America? I don't think so. You know, that's world governance. You know, it's a godless bunch of environmentalists trying to control our freedoms here. You know, you're going to hear a lot of that. And there's a suspicion of world governance and that somehow our interests are more important. The Paris conference is definitely going to be about nations subsuming their individual national interest to something greater. And in that sense, perhaps the greatest hope out of Paris, and we'll have time for one or two more questions, the greatest hope out of Paris is that it is a mechanism for world governance that's fundamentally different from what happened after 1945, where world governance was really all about stopping war. And we've failed miserably at that. I mean, we've certainly stopped war on the scale of World War II, for the time being. But the idea that we're going to stop the use of weapons and the proliferation of weapons has been a dreadful failure. In fact, the home of the United Nations is also the home of the greatest arms supplier on planet Earth, the United States. So the use of a United Nations to prevent war and unilateral action of governments that have gigantic militaries like China and the United States, China building islands in the South China Sea and claiming territory unilaterally without dealing with the United Nations, Israel's unilateral actions in the Middle East with no concern for the United Nations, the U.S.'s unilateral actions, the biggest of all, in Iraq, that defied the United Nations. Essentially defied the United Nations, although we did get a bit of a fig leaf there at the end with Colin Powell's performance in front of the Security Council. Not that any of that was true. It's a felony, actually, to lie in your civil court in right here in Burlington, actually. If you get up on the witness stand and lie, that's a felony. But lying in front of the world in the UN Security Council, you know, you can't even get a ticket for that, apparently. So apparently the model for world governance on something like climate change and hunger is perhaps a much more hopeful and practical model for bringing nations together. And we're seeing, even in the midst of the terrible stalemate over the civil war in Syria, much more cooperation going on the issue of climate change. Hopefully that's a sustainable model that will help to define this century's move away from individual narrow nationalism to something that is truly much more global. Let's have one more question in the back, and then I got a couple of questions right here in the front. Anybody in the back? Okay, shout out. We have had one woman. What's the census? Let's see. We're pretty good on diversity here. Right? Except for you're all white in this audience. But that's okay. It's fine. It's Vermont. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm wondering what you see as effective means of building the recognition that climate change exists as a problem and willingness to change behavior.
Say that again?
What do you see as effective means of building recognition that climate change is real, serious, a problem, and willingness to change behavior?
I think, having lived through Sandy and with an apartment that's in Zone 1 in New York, right next to the water, and having been evacuated for 2 weeks, which was, you know, nothing compared to the people who really suffered. I think imminent natural catastrophe is a terrific motivator. I do think that the more tangible the issue of our environmental impact, personal environmental impact is, the more the awareness rises. And it doesn't simply have to be seeing the tsunami wave coming your way. Although that helps, certainly. It's also seeing the choices that you might have to buy locally as opposed to buy Mexican raspberries when they're out of season in the United States, so that you can pretend as though everything's in season all the time. I mean, the locavore movement is something that you're all very familiar with here. So I think that at each level of the chain, both the consequences of climate change, the extent to which our choices have an impact on variables that we understand to be relevant in climate change, all that has become much more tangible. And that tangibility is the language through which awareness grows. Right here? Question? Right. I mean, it's okay. We welcome your five here on planet Earth. Right. So you're telling me my kids are a problem with the planet? Yeah, I see. Thanks a lot. That's a great start there. What are my thoughts on the issue of population as a driver of a lot of this, and the thoughts of in fact, the potential for population collapse among the human species? I would say that, you know, since the population bomb came out in the 1960s, Paul Ehrlich wrote that very famous book, The Predictions of a Population Collapse at the 3 billion level, at the 2 billion level, at the 4 billion level, and at the 10 billion level, and it now looks like 10 billion is not going to be a threshold for population collapse, and that will be reached in our lifetime, or many of our lifetimes here in this room. That is an unknown. What does that say? That says either humans are very stupid, which could certainly be one conclusion, but it also says that the biosphere has a load-bearing capacity that is not well understood. And, you know, if you define the impact of population as a zero-sum diminisher of the quality of individual lives within this civilization that's 10, 11, 12 billion, the question is, will people revert to some sort of prehistoric, kind of chaotic barbarity and diminish the population in that way because the scarcity of resources will produce huge conflict over things like water and food? Or will it force people to develop more rational means of sharing and exchange? In fact, the jury is out. There's plenty of evidence that scarcity of resources increases conflict in places like Turkey and Syria. But there's also evidence that it also increases mechanisms of exchange and sharing and workarounds. And if you go to places like Congo and Nigeria, where, yes, the notion that these are desperate places that are on the verge of collapse is palpable if you go into the ghettos of Lagos and the favelas in Rio, for instance. But you also see this, and I'm not being amoral or Malthusian here by saying, hey, great job, you know, cleaning up your hovel. But there is a huge capacity for humans being able to eke out an existence, which is an admirable skill, which speaks directly to the load-bearing capacity of the Earth. There's a great book I would recommend on this subject that will really cause you to think differently about questions of population and their complexity, way beyond the numbers. It's Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. It's a remarkable book about population explosion and the ghettos that crop up, in this case, right at the end of the runways at the airport in Mumbai. And basically a ghetto that people who squat in land that is next to a gigantic sewer pond. There's no plumbing. There's no electricity. And they create an existence and establish a political significance. And when the government decides to move them off and relocate them, they have an innate sense of pride in what they've created that they won't go. That is contrary to every assumption we have about what humans do in situations like that. I would highly recommend it. So my thoughts are, there is a point out there where there is some sort of collapse. It could be induced by some external force. It could be brought on by collective bad human behavior, or it could be postponed indefinitely by a fundamental shift in the way societies interact, which would include the end of the nation state as we know it, the much greater, more efficient use of electronic communications. It's no accident that cell phones are growing at an exponential rate in places like Nigeria and at a much slower rate here in the United States, because cell phones are an efficient energy workaround of in places where there's a lack of infrastructure and a hugely increasing population. So that's a long answer to a very profound and important question, and I would say Catherine Boo's book is a great beginning. I'll give you one. Give you the last question, since you were so patient. And
thank you.
Sure.
I'd like to have your views on the relevance or not of two items in relation to the policy development debate over climate. The first item is the research conclusion by Princeton political scientist Martin Gillen, who, after looking at almost 2,000 policy issues in Washington over the last 40 years, has concluded that whenever the policy preferences of the top 10% of all Americans by income differ from the policy preferences of the remaining 90% of us, over all that time and all those issues, there is zero statistically insignificant correlation with the policy preferences of the 90%. The second item is the conclusion and solution that would be offered by the Democratic presidential candidate Lawrence Lessig, if any of us got to hear it, and the DNC has definitely made damn sure by pre-selecting the candidates that we're not going to hear from him. But if we did, his argument is that the way we currently structure and finance our federal political system is so corrupt and so out of whack in terms of serving the interests of the American public, that we aren't going to make progress on climate change or a whole host of other issues that most of us hold dear unless and until we first fix our political system so that it will better serve citizen interests.
What I would say to that, and thank you for that question, although the length of it did cause me for a moment to regret that I gave you the last word there, but I'm a nice guy and I'll go with it. I mean, on the one hand, I would say that both of those observations are you know, deep and profound, but they're also obvious. The idea that the rich run things is an old story in America, and the idea that that democracy is about purely the numbers is contrary to reality over and over and over again. And you know, we only have elections every 4 years at the national level, and I don't even count the midterm elections because you're basically dealing with an incumbent who's probably going to win. It's very rare that an incumbent, a first-termer, gets thrown out of office. Jimmy Carter is the only one in Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush, but you can make the argument that George H.W. Bush was a continuation, was Reagan's third term, and so they weren't going to give him a fourth. And so George H.W. Bush was denied a second term. But in general, it's elections like 2016 where the electorate is allowed to weigh in. And so the only moment where it's possible for the 90% to impose its will on the 10% is in those rare moments like 2016. So you're right. I mean, I do think that the power structure is entrenched and it has a stake in maintaining the status quo. And if the consequences accrue unfairly to the 90%, but the 90% can't do anything about it, and the 10% have the capacity to insulate themselves indefinitely from those consequences, you're going to get a huge disconnect. I mean, a lot of people say the Koch brothers are progressive because they fund the renovation of the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Gosh, they must be really into art. That's a beautiful thing. They fund a cancer center at MIT and a huge cancer research center in New York, and I believe one out at Stanford. And people say, well, they're progressive. I mean, that's really great of them. Or you could look at it and say, well, if you're going to produce that much air pollution in the industry that has made you this rich, maybe it's a little bit like putting a $20 bill in the collection plate every Sunday to create a cancer center to deal with perhaps some of the impact of those particulates in rising of lung cancer or liver cancer or some of the other things that the industrial waste stream produces or is suspected to produce in the population. So I think you're right that our political system is greatly in need of reform, and Lessig makes a great argument. Where I think Lawrence is missing a huge piece of the puzzle, and I would very much love it if Lawrence would run for office, although I will say, having interviewed Lawrence a number of times, I think he makes Jeb Bush look like John Stewart in terms of just sort of personality, and he's a very, very smart guy, but in terms of just causing you to like want to, you know, walk 10 miles in a blizzard holding a political sign, I don't know if he's necessarily the candidate who would motivate you to do that. But that said, I think what Lessig misses is this thing that Al Gore talked about, and that is that the workarounds are the interesting place where politics is reforming the system. The traditional channels of legislation and the judiciary, and I mean, it's no accident that Obama's most progressive ideas came in his second term, where he'd already jettisoned Congress and was enacting everything by executive order. Essentially what Alexander Hamilton wanted to happen in the United States, that there would be no change if freedom was defined by everyone going off in their own corner and saying, leave me alone, to their neighbors, which is kind of the society we live in here in America, with the exception of Vermont, where everyone knows their neighbors and actually lives with their neighbors. But I do think that, it is this grassroots fundamental shift in discourse that is happening on issues like climate change. You see it on issues of race. I think the discussion of police brutality in urban centers around the United States, we had a week where we spent in St. Louis with the takeaway, and it's hugely important what's going on. We're having a discussion on the takeaway where responsible people are talking about, what if we had no police? That's not that we don't want police, but what would it mean to have a self-policing society where you wouldn't have a a special protected class of armed individuals called the police. Where do you really need police, and where do we just have them because it's a habit? And you know, this is a fascinating discussion, which bears directly on a progressive look at what our civil liberties are. Do we police ourselves, or do we rely on other people to do it? Who has a stake in the safety of our community? Is it the police, or is it us? These are fundamental, democratic, exciting questions that people are taking on in an environment where what Congress wants to talk about is, you know, Planned Parenthood and, you know, the sale of body parts from fetuses and, you know, stuff that not only, number one, is not a priority, but it has actually been going on for 40 years. And you know, the Republicans wouldn't have the health that they have today if it wasn't for the fact that there was a trade in Britain and in the United States of cadavers that probably wouldn't really look good on Sunday in church or on video, if there had been video back in Dickens' time. So, you know, these kinds of issues, these fringe issues, these wedge issues are what Congress wants to talk about. And at the grassroots level, and this again I think is the great hope that Lawrence should pay more attention to sometimes, even though I love his arguments and I think he's a profound political scholar, this is where the hope is. This is where the energy is. This is where the wheels are really turning in democracy right now. And, you know, it's certainly happening up here in Vermont. And I'm thrilled to be here, and not to talk to Democrats in the party sense, but certainly to talk to people who turn out on a beautiful fall evening in Wednesday, on a Wednesday, to have a discussion like this speaks very much to the vibrancy and health of our sort of intellectual orientation for using democracy as a way of designing the communities that we want to live in. I applaud you all for that. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
That was John Hockenberry speaking at St. Michael's College on November 4th.